Hello. Our guest today in Sounds Natural is a man of many, many parts. Comedian, actor, and not least a tenor with a voice that wouldn't be out of place in the famous opera houses of the world. Who else but Harry Secombe? Harry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Derek. Nice to be here.
In fine voice today, I'm glad.
Yes, sir. It's my brother singing, actually. Always stands in for me on records.
You know? Does he? To get down to Sounds Natural, how did you first become interested in wildlife?
Well, as a boy, you know, we used to go to the local cinema, could only escape from the surroundings in which we lived. I always wanted to go to Africa or up the Amazon or anywhere away from the docks, where we lived on this council estate in Swansea. And I remember seeing things like Trader Horn all over Africa. And I think it was called Chang, a film about a tiger called Shaitan, I think, which is a Hindu name or something for tiger. And those things intrigued me tremendously and always had this desire to see for myself. Mm-hmm. And when I did go, eventually, I mean, the first time I went was to North Africa in the war. On your side, of course.
Yes, glad to hear that.
With a Welsh Zulu regiment.
Bombardier Seacombe, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed, Lance Bombardier. It was to lead retreats, you know. Yeah. And it was natural then to take a camera. You weren't allowed to take a camera during the war. Right. But I saw quite a lot of interesting things then, and subsequently I've been able to indulge myself in cameras and taking photographs of animals in the natural surroundings.
Is this your particular enthusiasm, then, wildlife photography?
Well, I've always been keen on photography anyway, because from the time I was a kid, my father got a box brownie for smoking about 3,000 fags. Yes. Bronchitis in the process. I began taking pictures of my thumb at a very early age. So photography has always been a favourite pastime of mine, and animals always make good subject, as you know.
Yeah. Well, do you specialise in still photography or cine these days?
Well, mostly cine, 16mm. Mm-hmm. Quite expensive, but it's rewarding, you know, if they come out. If they don't, it's a bad time.
Do you do your own editing when you...
Yes, I do quite a bit of editing. My eldest lad, Andrew, and my youngest son, David, they help a lot. And, you know, I get all the things hanging them up and do the splicing and everything.
Laying soundtrack as well?
Yes, I do that as well. Mm. I provide most of the background effects myself.
I can believe that. Which animals would you say make the best subjects? Which one do you enjoy photographing?
Well, for me, big game, you know, elephants and rhinos and hippos. Could I feel I'm amongst people of my own size? I feel at home. And the BBC have used some of my film of elephant and also my thumb. Well featured.
You're still getting your thumb over
yes,
the
still,
lens,
yes,
are you?
Yeah, getting that thing caught in the lens cap.
I hope the BBC paid you for your film.
Paid me for my thumb.
When did you first meet a wild elephant face to face?
I was at the Murchison Falls National Park in Uganda. And we were coming around a corner. We just entered the reservoir. It says you're now in the national park and all that jazz. It doesn't look any different from the surrounding countryside. And we're going on this sort of dusty track, and suddenly around a corner, there was this tremendous thing. I mean, you see an elephant in the circus. You never see an African elephant in the circus or in a zoo. They're all mostly Indian elephants. But the African elephant is enormous. And I was frightened of my life. This thing stood in the middle of the road, and the driver said, just stay where we are. We won't go forward. I said, I was speechless with fright. But I think it's the tremendous size and the latent power in the thing when you see it. You know, it's frightening and exciting and everything all at the same time. Most tremendous experience.
Was this first one followed by a herd?
It was a sort of outrider for a herd of elephant aunties and what they call totos, the little ones, you know. And you've got to be careful because they demonstrate, as they call it. The ears come forward and the trunk goes up. That's telling you to keep away. So you naturally stop where you are. But the dangerous time, the fellas tell you, is when they the trunk goes up, the ears come forward, and they go back on their back legs. They're ready to charge, and they can get about 30 miles an hour, you know, off from the off. I didn't fancy it myself.
In the face of this frightening experience, did you remember to press the button on the camera?
I got it from the back. The funny thing about Murchison Falls is it's on the Nile, you know, on the tributary of the Nile. The elephants spray themselves with the mud. It's all sort of red soil. And they look like really pink elephants. It's very funny. You take pictures of them, these genuine pink elephants. Go and have another drink in the bar.
Well, I think it's time we heard a recording. How about an African elephant trumpeting?
What tune do you fancy? It. Oh, yes. And the other thing, too, you hear that the stomach rumbling all the time. I once got quite close to with a fellow in one of the game parks, quite close to a herd of elephants, because, you know, if you're downwind of them, they can't smell you. Their eyesight's very bad. Mm. And you hear the stomachs going all grumbling and rolling away, worse than me.
I haven't been to that part of the world, I must confess, but I believe that a highlight of a visit to Murchison is a launch trip up the Victoria Nile to the edge of Murchison Falls.
That's right. You go up to the from the Parral Lodge up the river to the falls itself, which is marvellous. You know, these water coming through this very narrow gap, and there's all sorts of crocs up there: elephant, crocodile, a few rhino, not many. Well, the crocs are quite interesting, crocodiles, because they're enormous. The Nile crocodile is a very big crocodile. And we have this bloke, Eric Sykes is with me in this particular time, and he's very funny to be with at the best of times. We saw a leopard once, and a cheetah. He said, what's that Dalmatian doing running about there with a collar off? Anyway, old Eric and I had this young lad who had this sort of flat-bottomed launch. And he said, do you want to see crocodile? I said, yes. He said, he took us very close in to these crocs, and they were very, you know, they looked somnolent, but they were watching us rather carefully, and they opened their jaws, and this tremendous gaping thing, because they've got quite small throats, and I was told, I would like to try, that you can hold the jaws shut with one hand, because the opening muscles are quite weak. I would like to try. I've been known as Lefty.
Yes, in view of what you say, it's rather interesting, because when we see them in zoos, they look very inactive.
Oh, they can go. They can really, you know, really scramble when they want to.
And you saw hippos there?
Plenty of hippos, yes. I saw more hippos in the Queen Elizabeth National Park, where they have a big concentration of them. Quite a few hippos at Murchison Falls.
They make a pretty wonderful noise, don't they?
Oh, great. That's it.
Do that again.
It's answering. I think we'd engage, you know. They sound like they agree with each other. Yes. It's like an old club, isn't it, in the Mall?
There are several of them grunting there, but here's a noisier selection, I think. There's a complete herd here in a pool, and there's snorting and grunting and all sorts of things going on. Front row of the audience.
It's a Christmas dinner, doesn't it? Well, he's getting quite excited, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where else have I seen hippos? Yes, near Lake Victoria. On the shores of Lake Victoria, there's this golf club called Ginger Golf Club. And in the rules, it says you're allowed to pick up your ball out of a hippopotamus footprint without penalty. Eric Sykes, incidentally, was playing with me. Eric had got into the rough, and he went to play his ball. And as he was about to take, you know, they actually had the club in the air to come down on the downswing. And this major Mike Harbidge, who was with us at the time, pushed him away. And the mamba scattered away from beneath his feet. It was within inches of getting bitten. Yeah. And a mamba, as you know, is quite a fairly poisonous reptile. So old Eric, then, every time his ball went in the rough, he wouldn't bother to look in the undergrowth. He used to put it back in the fairway for a new one.
And what other big game did you see there?
In Uganda, there's plenty of game. You know, there's a giraffe, buffalo, saw some buffalo there. Plenty of antelopes, of course. Mm. And because buffalo are quite interesting, because they talk so much about the buffalo being a very dangerous beast, especially if it's cornered alone. A lone buffalo is very dangerous, a rogue buffalo on its own. But in the herd, they seem very placid, almost like domestic animals.
Yeah, but I wouldn't fancy getting up fairly near to them to get a close-up with the camera.
Well, I actually, recently in South Africa, in a place called Mala Mala, we went through a whole herd of 400 buffalo in a Land Rover, through them, taking shots as we went. And no interference of any kind, no, they were just like going through a herd of cattle. But the danger, of course, is that there's always the odd one who, on his own, through probably old age or something, is left. And then they say that that's the only animal that will, if it's wounded, track the hunter. I don't know whether it's true or not, but lots of stories about buffalo.
To move on a little, Harry, you must have seen quite a variety of birds along the Victoria Nile.
Oh, yes, tremendous amount of birds. I'm not very good at birds, actually, but you see, in the sides of the bank, you see these nests that they make. And I don't know what kind of birds they are. They're these little, almost like swallows coming in and out and very quickly.
Yeah.
And also the big birds, the Goliath heron. That's a big bird, about my size, actually. There are lots of crown cranes and ibises, you know, they're the sacred ibis. And Hadada?
That's the one, yes. We can play a recording of the Hadada ibises, actually made in the Queen Elizabeth National Park in Uganda. There's a small flock of them here flying by.
How evocative the bird sounds are, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think that they bring back, even though I'm not very good at birds, not knowing much about varieties of birds, I think the bird cries, especially remind you of the African sunsets and evenings when they all come out. It's marvelous.
Did you find it was absolutely necessary to have a guide with you when you visited these various parks in Africa?
Oh, you definitely need somebody first of all, for protection, and tell you about the animals as you see them. There was this very nice bloke, at the Queen Elizabeth National Park in Uganda. It's in southeastern Uganda. A fellow called Frank Poppleton, who was a marvellous bloke, who knew all, had compassion for the animals, had been a hunter in his time, but knew them and knew everything he had on the place. And he took us all, because the Queen Elizabeth National Park itself, it's got this tremendous variety of habitats, you know, lakes and swamps and grassy plains and the tropical forests up to the Mountains of the Moon in the background. And marvelous, the Ruwenzori Mountains, they form this backcloth of these snow-capped peaks rising to about 16,000 feet. Tremendous things in the background. And there are marvelous signs in the park that elephants have right of way. And an ex-elephant hunter, Bill Pridham, took me one night, and a friend of mine, to the Semliki Flats. The Semliki is a river which forms the sort of border between what is now Zaire, it was then the Congo, and Uganda. And they were after some elephant poachers. And it was the first time I spent the night in the bush. And it was a marvellous experience. I thought, I'd seen these films, I'd read Hemingway, and I thought, well, this is going to be great, folks. We arrived at this camp about 2 hours before dusk, and there was just this one rondavel, a round hut, with a metal rondavel with a thatch roof, and just a sort of shanty-type thing. There's a table, and some chairs in the Land Rover, put them around, and a tilly lamp, you know. That went going, and then dusk came, and we all sat around. They built a fire, and they had these two Africans who were looking after us. They laid the meal out, and I thought, well, they'll be, you know, in true Hemingway tradition, they'll keep the fire going while the buanas go and have a kip, you see. But instead of that, as soon as they served us, they went into this steel hut and locked themselves in. And Bill Prudham said, well, after we had a few beers and a few drinks, well, that's it. He said, I'm off to Kip. And he strapped his rifle, this huge rifle he had, to the one of these supports, got into a sleeping bag and fell asleep. So my friend and I just sat there looking at each other, so wondering, all around us these sounds of elephant and lion and leopard, everything going on. And I kept, I kept throwing things on the fire. I threw my friend on to keep it going. And then I was brave enough to go and lie down and go to sleep. But I was very fitful sleep, I must say.
I wonder if we can remind you of that night in the bush with this recording of lions and spotted hyenas prowling about them.
Oh. That's the one. That's a lion. Oh, God, yes.
The hyena.
What's he been doing? Sounds of it's feeding, doesn't it?
That's right, yes.
On the hyena, man. No wonder he's whooping.
Yes, the hyenas are just...
keep you waiting. Yeah, they're waiting to come in, yes, because they have to take their turn. Gosh.
Well, after all, that's their place, isn't it?
Indeed, yes, yes. They all know their place in the the pecking order, or eating order.
Yeah. What were you hoping to see in the mountains of the moon?
There were so many things to see there, but actually, we went further down from the mountains of the moon to the range of mountains, a sort of extinct volcano, some extinct, some are alive, down on the near place called Kasoura, which is in Uganda, but borders on what is now Rwanda, what was then Rwanda, Urundi. And there's this range of mountains right along the border, into the Congo and into Rwanda, where the mountain gorillas are. And this is a place particular place we went to was called Muhavura. It's a almost perfect cone-shaped mountain, volcano, extinct volcano, with, you start off about 12,000 feet up, you know, through the Kanaba Gap, they call it, and then you look and you see this, you think 12,000 feet high, and then you look and you see this thing even further up. It's incredible. And there's a place at Kasoura called the Traveller's Rest. It's a collection of these rondavel huts, and the place was run by a bloke called Wally Baumgartel, who would take you up to see this gorilla, you know, or ostensibly to find them. And all around the place were pictures of gorillas, you see, all around the huts, there are photographs inside. And before you go up the mountain, which is dead straight, you know, it's a perpendicular climb along a water course to a saddle camp, and you go from there further up. Before you do this climb, he gives you a pep talk. First of all, you have to sign a form saying that you absolve them from any blame if anything happens to you, which is a big decision to make. So I signed this, and he said, now you're going up the mountain for the gorilla. He said, now perhaps Reuben is coming with you as a guide. Reuben, he's a fellow with ear holes right down over his shoulders, you know, this sort of slit ear thing. He said, Reuben is coming with you to show the gorillas. And he said, perhaps you're lucky for seeing the gorilla. And from the bush is coming the old man, or the old auntie from the gorilla family. While the gorilla family is making the retreat, out comes the old man, and is making the demonstration with the face and beating the chest. But you're holding the ground. And then perhaps he's taking a branch from the tree and shaking the branch in the face. But you're holding the ground. So I said, what happens if I don't hold the ground? He said, if you're not holding the ground, then the gorilla might take off the head and throw down the hill. I said, that's very nice. That's before you go up there. Because that is one of the peculiarities. They twist off your nut and throw it. Anyway, we went up there. We went up to the saddle camp and got a bit further up. Saw plenty of bush elephant, bush buffalo, which is a smaller variety. Plenty of other things, but no gorilla. I heard them in the distance, didn't see any. And when I got back down, I looked round at the photographs on the wall of these gorilla and realised that they'd been taken at the Nairobi National Museum of stuffed gorillas. You very rarely see them.
Yeah. I'm sorry you were disappointed, Harry, but we can play you recordings of sounds you might have heard if you'd been somewhat luckier. Mountain gorillas barking as they move through the forest on Mount Visoki in Buamba. Probably breaking bamboo.
Yeah, bamboo and celery, wild celery. Because they are vegetarian. Mm. They make these nests. Younger ones sleep in the trees, but the big ones are too big. They make sort of nests. And they live in family lines, you know, as the mountains. They're very gentle, really. Antisocial, of course, but gentle.
But living in social groups.
Yes, yeah. Always, yes. Mm. Not much of a noise, but this chest drumming is quite fun.
That would scare you if you weren't expecting it.
Yes, don't fancy those at all.
Well, where else in the world have you gone in your enthusiasm? You're looking for places to photograph wildlife.
You see, West Indies, not much wildlife there, a lot of bird life. And fishing, you know, plenty of fishing. Mexico, Venezuela, Sarawak, Kuching, which is in Sarawak, Hong Kong, Singapore, Fiji, India, Australia, you name it.
I should have put the question the other way around. Where haven't you been, I think?
Oh. Yeah. Barnsley? No, I haven't been there.
And British West Hartlepool.
Indeed. Yeah. I've also spent a marvellous Christmas about 3 years ago on Dunk Island, which is on the Great Barrier Reef, because it's a fascinating area, but some very nasty things in the water there. They've got crown of thorns jellyfish, which are destroying the
coral.
The coral, unfortunately. Yeah. Sea wasps. Blue bottles, they call them, with these like Portuguese men of war type things, jellyfish with long tentacles, which paralyze you in the water and can kill. And stonefish, which are quite nasty things. They look like very ugly fish, and they also have them in the Seychelles, so it's quite tricky if you step on them, because your leg gets swelled to the size of a tree trunk.
You don't recognise them because it looks a bit like a stone.
Yes, that's it. That's why they call them stonefish. Yeah. My son was fishing quite pleasantly off a rock and caught a 4-foot black-tipped shark, which frightened the life out of him and me. Mm. But the Seychelles, as I say, they're very rich in wildlife, and I wanted to go to see Bird Island, which is one of the islands off Mahé, which is the main island. But the weather was so bad, we picked the wrong time. Yeah, Christmas time, because it's the sort of monsoon season. Because there they've got this enormous colony of sooty, wide awake terns. Even though I didn't hear them, I was told that there's nearly 500,000 pairs there, and the noise is deafening.
Well, this is something you missed.
I'm glad I missed it.
Sooty or wide awake terns, the breeding colony on Bird Island in the Seychelles. That's where it was actually recorded.
It's a beautiful place, the Seychelles. You know, it's a marvellous place to visit, because there's so many little islands around, so these little jewels in the sea. Marvellous.
But isn't it like so many of these other faraway places? It's tending to become exploited these days.
Well, yes, I suppose it is. They built a landing strip there now. Previously, up until about, you know, within the last 10 years, the only sort of communication there was the ship that came in from Mombasa or somewhere. Now, of course, the big jets fly in there, and the people are quite bewildered. They really are. They don't quite know what's hit them. But I'm also fascinated by turtles, because there in the Seychelles, they have these giant turtles. And the big tortoises as well. I saw one turtle on the beach, and I was hoping to lay some eggs, as I'd see them do in films, but it didn't.
You had your camera handy, obviously.
Yeah, I did, yes. I got a shot of it, yes. But it didn't lay any eggs. I think it got lost.
They make a tremendous noise when they lay their eggs, don't they? And they come out of
so I believe,
the sea,
yes,
onto the beach,
yes,
at night. The snoring and sighing as they lay their eggs.
Oh, that's the sand going back. They move the sand over the edge of the lane, don't they? Yes. How much, they lay a lot at a time, too, don't they?
Tremendous number of eggs,
yeah. What are they saying, the sobbing?
And yet so very, very few of those eggs
survive, unfortunately. I saw that marvellous film. Was it a Cousteau film where you see these eggs hatching and trying to make their way... The turtle trying to make their way to the sea and being attacked by the birds.
A tremendous number of turtles have disappeared, and other species as well, I suppose it's true to say, because of their need, or our need possibly, for food, and there's pollution as well, which has intervened. What do you feel about the need for wildlife conservation today?
Well, I think it's terribly important, because anybody who's seen animals in the wild, in their own natural habitat, would never want to shoot them or kill them, because they look so magnificent, they look so right. You see a giraffe, it looks an ungainly animal in the zoo. You see it on a plane, moving. They're marvellous, this undulation. You see an elephant, you see the frightening size of it. You see a lion, and that's difficult to see, lions, you know, especially with a lion lying in the grass, if the grass is high. And these marvellous gazelles, the dik-diks and the little dickers and all these Tommies, the Thompson gazelles and the sable antelope with a marvellous sweep of horn. You know, why should they destroy them? And the trouble is, of course, in parts of Africa, they're regarded as meat, you know, and they aren't looked upon. And I think the important thing for wildlife preservation is to educate the African to realize that those animals are part of his heritage, and he has to preserve them for other people to see.
Harry Secombe, thank you very much for coming along to talk to us in Sounds Natural. It's been a most interesting conversation, and we've heard some most interesting recordings along the way as well.
We have indeed, haven't we?
Shall we finish with some more of that leatherback turtle?
Ah, yes.
On the beach, laying its eggs.
Very sad.
Yeah, sobbing about the fate of its race, I wonder?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Harry Secombe, thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you, Derek.
Derek Jones was talking to Harry Secombe in January 1976. The producer of Sounds Natural was John Burton.